This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stachow. Many of us are fascinated by the question of who our ancestors were. This question is a greater mystery for groups whose lineage has been obscured by the need to survive under racial purity laws. Consider the Melungeons, who lived in the mountains of North Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee for centuries. No one knows precisely their origins, but slavery and later Jim Crow forced them to deny what was almost certainly African and American Indian heritage. Increasingly, though, descendants are embracing their ancestry, and they, along with genealogists, historians, and geneticists, are exploring the mystery of their origins. The Melungeon Heritage Association met earlier this month in Swannanoa in the North Carolina mountains. It's a group that's attracting steadily growing interest. Joining me today is K. Paul Johnson. He's corresponding secretary for the Melungeon Heritage Association. Also with us is Julie Williams-Dixon. She is a filmmaker who lives in Raleigh, and her documentary Melungeon Voices came out last year. Paul, Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
I suppose we should start with what seems like a simple question, but of course isn't. Paul, what is a Melungeon?
The first appearance of the term is as a rough synonym of mulatto, but with the implication of triracial heritage, that is, European, Native American, and African. And it was always used as an epithet by outsiders, and you would never, before about 50 years ago, hear somebody say, I am a Melungeon. It was always a term used to imply that somebody's ancestry was impure.
So the definition of the group is somewhat elusive, but there are defining characteristics. What are those?
Triracial heritage is the most typical one that is either perceived or documented at this point, mixture of those three elements. And we will have to make the point that that there is no such thing as three separate races, but that was the social perception. Mm-hmm. Isolation geographically is a characteristic of most of these groups that fell between the cracks of white, black, and Indian. They were either in the swamps of eastern North Carolina or in the mountains of Tennessee, but places where there was less valuable land and these mixed communities were sort of pushed away to be in their own enclaves. And there's also, you know, the traditional phrase that you hear is nobody knows what they are. Well, there's a shame associated with not knowing. So I'd say that's a characteristic, is a real sense of mystery about origins, both by outsiders and among Melungeons themselves.
Well, Julie, in making your film, Melungeon Voices, you spoke at length to a man named Brent Kennedy, and he was one of the catalysts for this sort of interest. Tell us a bit about him and how you came to be involved with his quest.
Okay. I grew up down the street from Dr. Brent Kennedy, and in 1988, Dr. Kennedy was finally diagnosed with sarcoidosis and familial Mediterranean fever, diseases that most often affect people of Mediterranean or Middle Eastern or African descent. And at that point, he said, wow, I guess we're not Scots-Irish. And so I was at a crossroads in my career, so to speak, had been doing mostly corporate work, and approached Dr. Kennedy about producing a film about the Melungeons. My family at that same time was deeply involved in researching our own genealogy. And my older brother said, have you read Brent's book? And I said, no. And once I read the book, I was like amazed at what I found and saw so many references to people that I had grown up with and realized that I had quite a connection to it.
And it's interesting in talking about Brent Kennedy that, of course, he came down with this disease, and that gave him a hint. But in fact, there had been hints before that. And I actually want to play a clip from your film in which he talks about the first inkling that he had of this connection.
The real moment for me came when I was around probably 11 years old, and I went to the Coal Town Theater in Norton, Virginia, and saw Lawrence of Arabia. And I loved the movie, and I knew I was supposed to identify with the English, but I sat there transfixed the whole time as what appeared to me to be Mullinses and Nashes and Osbournes were sweeping across the desert on camels and horses, and it was just stunning. And so I went home, and I asked my mom about it. I said, you know, Mom, why does our family look like the Arabs? And she really didn't have an answer, but she also didn't deny it either.
And it is so interesting in watching the film, and you have so many photos and historical photos of these families, and there's so many different looks to these families, and a great deal of them are not what we would consider traditionally white. Paul, there's been some DNA testing among Melungeon people recently. I mean, what kind of tests have there been?
Well, the first test that got a lot of notice was a mitochondrial test, and that was taken from hair samples. And this was not a controlled sample. This was 120 people who showed up at the Third Melungeon Union in Wise, Virginia. So self-selected people who are interested in the topic. That came up with 5% Native American and 5% Sub-Saharan haplogroups. And the mitochondrial is female line, your mother's mother's mother, and 90% European. The next wave of interest was in a Y test that traces the male line, and that was more restricted in focus to just people with known Melungeon surnames from the Newman's Ridge area of Tennessee. That showed no Native American haplogroups. It's all, as far as I know, either European or Sub-Saharan, and the prevalence of Sub-Saharan is closer to one-third. One of the interesting things in that study is that many of the traditional Melungeon surnames have both European and Sub-Saharan haplogroups. So with Collinses and Goinses and Bunches, there do seem to be both African and European origins. The most recent study that we got a report on at this event just a couple of weeks ago was an autosomal study, which is all the other chromosomes than the Y and the mitochondrial studies. And that showed the triracial pattern, yes, confirmed all three of those elements, but also some unusual prevalence of what seemed to be Jewish, Arabic, and South Asian markers.
Just from it's fascinating. I mean, it's just everything is in there. I mean, Julie, talk about the experience that that Brent had and other people that you knew had when. I mean, Brent said that when he first went to his mother, for instance, after having seen the Lawrence of Arabia and had those thoughts, or after he came down with sarcoidosis, the response from families not always supportive.
Well, what you have to keep in mind is that for generations, people tried to hide this this ethnic brew that they were. And I want to clarify one thing. We keep using the term triracial, but what Dr. Kennedy brought to the story was this is not as simple as triracial. And if we go back to the 1790 census, that's when here in America you had to check off as being white, black, Indian, or mulatto. So we immediately in colonial America took away all the chances for people to self-identify as other ethnicities. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Melungeons become so mysterious, because it becomes obvious that they are much more complex than just triracial. But back to your question about what happened. In one case, one of Brent's family members burnt all of the family history and genealogy records that she had so that he could not get to them. Wow. I mean, it was a very tough thing to come forward and say you are Melungeon until about 10 years ago.
Well, what are the oral traditions that Melungeons have passed down? I mean, since even if they haven't burnt things, many things have been lost in terms of actual paper records.
Well, a lot of people self-identified as Indians. But the other thing that comes up over and over if you start studying the Melungeons is that the old-timers back in the 1790s, early 1800s, many of them identified as Portuguese. Hmm. And so when you start to try to trace why might they have said that they're Portuguese, this opens up looking at many other theories of origin. And that's what Brent's book does. And there's another book people should reference, Walking Toward the Sunset by Wayne Winkler. And that's what my film does. It sort of lays out all the potential theories of origin. And we kind of leave people to draw their own conclusions. It's very mysterious at some levels, but at other levels, it's not mysterious. There is a paper trail for these families. We can trace them back. If you look at 16th century Indian genealogy in Virginia, you find many clues as to who this group of people were. And remnant bands from Indian tribes in Virginia made their way west, and many of them ended up in the mountains of Tennessee.
Well, and how would the Portuguese have gotten to the mountains of Tennessee and Virginia?
Boy, this could be a long answer, and I'm going to try to make it short. There are a couple of ways. We have records that Portuguese came with the Spanish. There was a Spanish settlement along the coast of South Carolina at Santa Elena in the late 1500s. We know there are records that Juan Pardo went into the mountains. He built a series of forts. He left soldiers there. Some of them were Spanish. Some of them were Portuguese. Juan Pardo was of Portuguese heritage. We know that they admixed with Indians there. So that's one possibility. There's also records that show that there were Portuguese colonies in South Carolina that admixed with Indians along the Petit River, who then made their way into the mountains of southwest Virginia and east Tennessee.
And, of course, the Portuguese had also had a colony in Angola, I believe, right? And so there's also a theory that native Angolans may have come with those Portuguese ships, and that might be in the bloodline now as well.
That's a possibility.
And archaeologists are exploring a site in Catawba County in North Carolina, is that right?
Right, near Morganton. Mm-hmm. Right, and this is a fascinating piece of North Carolina history that is just now coming to light. There's pretty good evidence now that that's where Juan Pardo, his last fort, it was at an Indian town called Jawara, and the archaeologist digging there is a man named David Moore. And they have evidence now that the Spaniards were living with the Native Americans in around 1567 or so. And many people now refer to this as the first lost colony because it predated what we have always termed the lost colony along the coast.
Paul, one reason that Melungeons, you know, obscured their history, of course, was due to slavery and white supremacy. And how did this force Melungeons underground, so to speak?
The situation got steadily worse for Americans of mixed ancestry from the 17th century onward. You had Virginia allowing interracial marriage up until 1691 and then forbidding it. North Carolina followed suit early in the 18th century. But by then, you already have a large mixed population that has been born of legitimate unions that tends to be absorbed into the free black population. This group of people, their existence is now sort of illegal. That is, you're not supposed to be creating any more of these mixed people. And therefore, the ones who are still around, the fortunate ones are assimilated into an Indian community or a white community or a free black community. But there are many people whose in-betweenness is irritating to their neighbors. The state laws are unwelcoming increasingly to mixed ancestry people. They're not allowed to move freely. So Virginia and North Carolina being so hostile towards people of mixed ancestry, especially after the Nat Turner insurrection, continually forced people westward trying to find places where they could live with greater freedom. Tennessee initially providing a great haven where free people of color could vote for the first 40 years of the state's existence. Hmm. Then they lost that right.
Well, and I want to actually go back to the film once more here and hear from a woman named Johnny Ray. And I mean, she's talking here about how her attitude toward her identity has changed in recent years. But you can hear how all of that obscuring that happened through all those years was ended up being internalized, I think, and passed down.
I'm a legend. I left to be one. Used to, I didn't. So that
why did you want to be one?
They put us down. You didn't like, they was put us real low people. You didn't want to be that. You would try to be a little, we'd come out of the woods now. 10 years ago, you come and said, I'm Melungeon. I'd been ready to fight you. We'd put you out of here.
Paul, have you seen this transformation occurring in the Melungeon community? And even saying the Melungeon community now, I mean, that's not something that even would have been said not long ago, I think.
Yes, I just saw Johnny Ray a couple of weeks ago, and she is just the heart and soul of our unions and exemplifies, she and Claude Collins, who I think we might also hear from, people who grew up in Hancock County at a time when the Melungeons were clearly a distinct ethnic group. They weren't supposed to go to the same schools as the white people, and they were not supposed to be, you know, you were never supposed to call them a Melungeon to their face, just behind their backs. And to see these people have such pride now in a heritage that was a cause of such shame to their parents' generation is really heartwarming and very positive change.
And Julie, I mean, an interesting thing that you say in the film is that One of the reasons that it never occurred to you that, say, Brent Kennedy, for instance, might have Melungeon ancestry was that his family was middle class and well-to-do, and that is not – I mean, the stereotype of Melungeons as poor and backwoods was still holding then.
That's right. There's definitely a socioeconomic part of this story. Melungeons were pushed to the fringes of society economically. So his family, and if in the film this is revealed, his mother's family was often referred to as the Black Nashes. But they had made their way, quote unquote, into town by that point and lived in our middle class neighborhood. So we would have never thought of him as a Melungeon at that point.
Right.
If I look through my high school annual and look at the faces of the people I went to school with, if I look at the faces of my brother and my father, there's more to our story than Scots-Irish. I mean, you know, I grew up thinking I was a white Scots-Irish girl, and now I know it's much more complex than that for me. And I embrace that very much.
And, of course, what does that say about what the word white, I mean, even means? I think it really challenges the very meaning of that, as clearly the definition of that word has changed over time.
Right. And that's the tricky part of talking about this story. You know, it's racially charged.
Right. Well, and Paul, you know, the Melungeons are one of many groups of people with hazy origins. I wonder if you could talk for a second about the Lumbee Indians of Robeson County, which are similar in some way.
Yes. The triracial mixture occurred all throughout coastal Carolina in the first centuries of after contact. And it produced different mixtures. What little I've seen of DNA testing about the Lumbee community suggests that they're roughly equally triracial, that is, equal parts now Indian, European, and African in their DNA. Culturally, they're Indian. They have a continuity of Indian identity in saying, we are Indian. Whereas the groups like Melungeons have been in a no man's land where they haven't been claimed by either white, black, or Indian. One of the interesting developments of MHA in recent years is having different communities come forward with different testimonies. So that, for example, I come from an area that was always white identified back to 1750s when there were colonial mulattoes. But there's still many of these culture traits. 10 miles up the road, we have Marvin Jones in a community that was always considered free people of color. Many Melungeon-like traits and claims of mixed ancestry. And then 10 miles the other way, a community of slave descendants. And they, too, say, we are mixed. We have Indian heritage. So in eastern North Carolina, you have white, black, and mixed people saying we are part Indian. And I think we're now ready to understand that Melungeons are just a symbol, really, or a microcosm of what's true throughout the state, probably throughout the Southeast.
And perhaps throughout the entire country, even. It's a fascinating thing, and it we have a lot to learn from it, it seems, about race in America and the history of America as well. I want to thank both of you for joining us here on The State of Things. My guests have been K. Paul Johnson. He's the recording secretary for the Melungeon Heritage Association, and Julie Dixon Williams. She's the writer and director of the film Melungeon Voices. I'm sorry, Julie Williams Dixon. Excuse me. Paul will be speaking about Melungeons on August 10th at a meeting of the Forsyth County Genealogical Society. That'll be at the Maine Public Library in Winston-Salem. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
For more information about Melungeons, you can go to melungeon.org. That's spelled M-E-L-U-N-G-E-O-N. And for more on Julie's film, go to melungeonvoices.com. Coming up, everything you ever wanted to know about steampunk. Stay with us on The State of Things.